Thanks to everybody for coming tonight. So this is the talk about the American adventure writer Jack London. I'm going to focus very much on his text, The People of the Abyss. I'm sure many of you will be familiar with this text. I'll talk about 40, 45 minutes, and then hopefully we have a little bit of time for questions and maybe more wine if you feel so inclined. First, a bit about Jack London. Jack London is probably one of the most charismatic American writers of the turn of the 20th century. He rose to fame with stories and nature tales set in Canada's Yukon territories during the Klondike gold rush in the late 19th century. That's what he is in America at least familiar with. His biography is very, very interesting. He was born as the illegitimate child of a struggling working-class mother. He was born in the San Francisco Bay Area. He was adopted by the man his mother would eventually marry. He was self-educated for large parts of his life, went to high school on and off, entered the University of California at Berkeley in 1896, but then had to withdraw after 1 year because of financial problems. After that, he had a stint as an oyster pirate, again in the San Francisco Bay Area. He sailed the Pacific on a schooner for a few years. He traveled across the United States as a hobo, served a short prison sentence, joined the Klondike Gold Rush in 1897, and while he was doing all this, also became a very, very committed socialist. He was quite busy, and all that before he turned 20. Mainly because of his political opinions and commitments, he eventually turned to what he would call the writing game. I like that idea, the writing game. So he turned to writing because he thought that that the political structures in the United States and elsewhere had to be criticized, and the best way of doing this would be in print. This seemed to be, for him, the most effective way of drawing attention to problems, social and political problems, of contemporary America and the contemporary scene. So, Jack turns his experiences in the Yukon Territories into commercially successful stories and novels. So, for instance, the publication of The Son of the Wolf in 1900, which is a collection of short stories about the gold rush, brought him certainly to critics' attention, but what did not necessarily secure a steady income. But success came virtually overnight in 1903 with the publication of the novel The Call of the Wild. And like many of his earlier stories, this text was set in the Yukon Territories during the high period of gold prospecting in the Klondike. But what is really interesting about this novel, I don't know if anyone has actually read it, but he decided to make a sled dog, so an animal, the protagonist of the novel, which is an interesting choice. And I think he did that for particular reasons. I want to talk a little bit about it because it hopefully will give a bit of context to understand maybe also his later writing, to which I will turn in a moment. So when this story begins, Buck is the protagonist of this novel. It's a domesticated dog. It's robbed from its owners. And then, sort of, if you imagine, sold into slavery. So he has to then work as a sled dog in the Yukon Territories. And over the course of the novel, he not only learns to adjust to this very sort of brutal living conditions he's subjected to, but he also reverts to his primordial origins. And by the end of the novel, he's sort of turns into a sort of unrivaled leader in the wild. I think already apparent in this early novel are aspects of Jack London's thinking that would preoccupy him throughout his writing career. So the fascination with strength and willpower in the face of adverse living conditions, the exposure of very brutal and of the brutality and mismanagement in established social and political structures, and a related critique of capitalism and a capitalist civilization, in quotation marks, that Jack held responsible for wholesale exploitation of the masses. The 1906 novel White Fang would deal with similar themes and topics. And this time, the novel looks at the domestication of the wild wolf dog, White Fang, the eponymous hero here, protagonist. Again, the story that is told from the perspective of a canine or lupin narrator or narratorial focus here. And like his companion novel, The Call of the Wild, this story, as I said, is told from the perspective of an animal protagonist. And that's why, at this point, loads of critics and loads of academics who've got an interest in animal studies now turn to Jack London's writing. I'm just going to very briefly talk about the other novels listed here. The Sea Wolf deals with, published in 1904, deals with the very brutal conditions on board of a seal hunting schooner. Martin Eden, published in 1909, is a very autobiographical novel about an autodidact who's trying to become a commercially successful writer, fails ultimately because of circumstances beyond his control. And additionally, which the text I find particularly interesting is the Kempton Wace Letters from 1903. This is a book that Jack London co-authored, and it is an epistolary novel that discusses love and sex from a romantic and on the other hand a scientific perspective. So two antagonistic perspectives and viewpoints presented in the form of letters that are a correspondence written between someone called Herbert Waite, who's this young scientist, and who is in this book represented by Jack London. So we've got a young scientist, and on the other hand, an elderly poet by the name of Dane Campton, and he is represented, or his letters are written by a young woman called Anna Stronsky, who is often now considered Jack London's first, sort of proper love interest. So they had a lot to say to each other, especially given that topic, and that topic that fascinated them, just not just in this particular epistolary correspondence. Additionally, Jack wrote many other novels and short stories, mainly for commercial reasons, but the text I really want to talk about now, and it's the focus of today's lecture, is the one into which he apparently, as he said in one of his letters, put more of his heart into than any other of his books that he ever wrote. And obviously, I'm talking here about the text, The People of the Abyss, published in 1903. And as I said, I'm sure many of you will be familiar with this text. If not, I hope after this lecture you might want to read this. The facts that led to the publication of The People of the Abyss can be very quickly summarized. So Jack London agreed in 1902 to report on the aftermath of the Boer War in South Africa, and then suddenly found himself without a commission when the American press that had contracted him decided to pull the plug on the story as soon as Jack London arrived from California in New York in the summer of 1902. But instead of returning home, Jack decided to travel on to London, and he arrived there in August 1902 with sort of a vague notion, as he would say in one of his letters, I think I've got it here, to do a bit of writing on some writing on this London slums, while also getting, as he said in another letter, a vacation. I think it's not in this letter. I'll come to this in a moment. I'm not sure if I agree with the kind of vacation Jack London had in mind. It might have also certainly met with consternation by many of his contemporaries. So indeed, shortly after arriving in England's capital, London town, as he calls it throughout his text, he settled not in a posh hotel, but in a room in the East End. And here in the East End, he spent about 7 weeks writing about aspects of slum life that he encounters on a daily basis. The result was then the publication of The People of the Abyss, a sociological study of urban poverty poverty and neglect that paid tribute to, but nonetheless departed in very interesting ways from previous narratives published by so-called slum travellers. And I think what distinguished Jacks from previous sociological studies is that the author here tries to remove the barrier, as much as that is possible, between observing subject and observed object. So, in other words, as I said, he would try, as much as possible, immerse himself in the life of the slum dwellers that he was observing and who would then obviously become the focus of his book. And this transformation was facilitated mainly by clothes. So he bought a pair of second-hand clothing before venturing into the East End. And in this disguise, he took on this new persona of a slum inhabitant and lived the life, as I said, as much as that as possible, of you know, the average East Ender. And although in many ways he came to similar conclusions as his predecessors, other slum tourists, his approach, I think, to meeting the residents of the London slum, his sort of slums, his desire to brush against them, also, I think, produces a text that is in many ways different, departs certainly in parts at least, from these by now very formulaic constructions of East End poverty. As many of you will certainly know, depictions of slum life in texts such as by Arthur Morrison or in studies such as William Booth in Darkest England and The Way Out from 1890 constructed the East End and also its inhabitants as something that was beyond and outside of the experiences, codes and customs of the respectable middle class society. And if there was compassion in these texts for the plight of the East Enders, there was also certainly a sort of understandable desire by the observers to maintain a safe distance, sort of physically but also, you know, emotionally, rhetorically, from the misfortunes that they encountered and that they reported and commented on in their texts. So, as a result, slum inhabitants were often constructed as cultural others. In some of these early accounts, they're depicted as savages without any veneer of civilization, comparable to the indigenous people in darkest Africa. People and places that also became the subject of many anthropological studies at about the time when Jack London ventured into the East End. Now, Jack's own account departs, as I said, from these earlier narratives about East End slum life. Not only, as I said, did his author assume the identity of an East Ender, but his text also accommodates very different narrative perspectives and voices to express political critique. And what I want to propose in this lecture tonight is that the text's discursive range, so the fact that it contains so many different, if not sometimes incompatible, narrative styles, different voices, was facilitated by the particular approach used by Jack when he collected his impressions of the East End. So I said he went into the East End in disguise. So he appropriated the persona of a working class man, just quite literally changing his clothes and changing his identity when changing his clothes. I think this performance of a new self is somewhat indicative of his interest in experimenting with different identities, with different roles, different disguises. And I think the very same diversity is apparent on a textual level in the People of the Abyss. Here he simply experimented with different narrative voices and perspectives. I think, for me at least, this is one of the most compelling accounts of early 20th century slum life that I've encountered. And one that very effectively, I think, mixes repertorial observation, personal commentary, and a very, very powerful socialist critique of modern capitalism. So, and how does he do it? How does he comment, actually, on his experiences in the East End in the summer of 1902? You might start by looking at some of his lectures, his letters from the time. Very predictably, these give a sense of the sort of horror and dismay about the scenes, places, and incidents he witnessed at first hand. He says here in this letter from 22nd of August 1902, he says, "This country is the country God has forgotten that he forgot." And then he continues, "I've read of misery and seen a bit, but this beats anything I could ever have imagined. Actually, I've seen things and looked the second time in order to convince myself that it was really so." So indeed, so shocking were the things Jack must have observed that he proposed that he should, later on here in the same letter says, that he should die if he had to live 2 years in the East End of London. At the same time, he also worried that no publisher would touch his book, probably because of the graphic descriptions provided, but also because of the sheer volume of material that he accumulated in the very few weeks during which he lived underground, as you would say, in the East End. The final published version, however, begins in a rather measured way. So, in the preface to The People of the Abyss, Jack notes fairly matter-of-factly that, quote, "The experiences related in this volume fell to me, and he was not actively seeking them out, they fell to me in the summer of 1902. I went down into the underworld of London with an attitude of mind which I may best liken to that of the explorer. I was open to be convinced by the evidence of my eyes rather than by the teachings of those who had not seen or by the words of those who had not seen and gone before. Further, I took with me certain simple criteria with which to measure the life of the underworld. That which made for more life, for physical and spiritual health, was good. That which made for less life, which hurt and dwarfed and distorted life, was bad." Now note in this short passage, his appropriation of this sort of appropriation of the explorer's viewpoint, Jack explains that he ventured into the East End with this attitude of mind that he compares to that of an explorer. He reminds once again encounter Jack's love of adventure, expressed also in the earlier published stories about the Klondike Gold Rush. But his choice of expressions here is also, I think, very reminiscent of the kind of writing preceding the People of the Abyss, the text that constructs the slums of London's East End as sort of terra incognita, as dark, unknown places evocative of the darkest corners of Britain's vast colonial empire. However, Jack also asserts that he planned to start his journey into the underworld, as he called it, without any preconceived notions or prejudices, if such a thing is actually possible. So he proposes that he refuse to be guided by the teachings of other slum travellers. Instead, he offers a set of very simple and very plausible guidelines that he says that he relied on when forming an opinion on the scenes witnessed in the East End, that which made for more life, for physical and spiritual health, he proposes, was good, than that which made for less life, which hurt and dwarfed and distorted life, was bad. And armed with these straightforward principles, Jack then ventured into the underworld in the summer of 1902, collecting impression, taking numerous photographs, speaking to people, and living, certain times at least, the life of a slum dweller. Now, and if we keep Jack's very basic principles in mind, we will soon realize when reading The People of the Abyss that he found in the streets, the dwellings, the daily lives of the slum inhabitants, much indeed that hurt and dwarfed and distorted life. Here is, for instance, one description capturing one of his first impressions of life in the East End. He says, early on in the text, "Nowhere in the streets of London may one escape the sight of abject poverty, while 5 minutes' walk from almost any point will bring one to a slum. But the reach of my hansom was now penetrating was one unending slum. The streets were filled with a new and different race of people, short of stature and of wretched or beer-sodden appearance. When we rolled along through miles of bricks and squalor, and from each cross street and alley flashed long vistas of bricks and misery, here and there looked a drunken man or woman, and the air was obscene with sounds of jangling and squabbling. At the market, totty old men and women were searching in the garbage thrown in the mud for rotten potatoes, beans and vegetables, while little children clustered like flies around a festering mass of fruit, thrusting their arms through the shoulders into the liquid corruption and drawing forth morsels but partially decayed, which they devoured on the spot. Now, I think, again, we find in this very short paragraph the conventional imagery that readers of slum fiction and slum narratives of the turn of the century would have been familiar with. They have vivid, very graphic descriptions of disorder, dirt, and decay. Note that, for instance, Jack considers the inhabitants of the slums as a new and different race. He evokes again this idea, the contemporary stereotypes about the East End and its inhabitants that were disseminated in earlier slum narratives, the sort of comparative reading of East End working class existence and, you know, the life led by colonial subjects, you know, elsewhere in Africa or in other colonies. And this is something that, as I said, turn of the century Britons probably very, very familiar with. And obviously from the perspective of the middle classes, slum inhabitants and colonial subjects seem to resemble each other in many ways, in that they had not reached a certain level of civilization. Again, you know, quotation marks, and sort of that was deemed appropriate. So they were therefore in need of patronage, education, and management. And as I said, Jack's narrative seems to reproduce some of this imagery, some of these stereotypes that were sort of widely disseminated at the turn of the 20th century. However, in other places, his observations are evaluative and analytical rather than prejudiced, I think. This we can see, for instance, in descriptions of individual working lives, especially in chapters that provide what I would call case studies of men, women, and children living and working in the East End and working particularly in the sweated industries. And in these cases, it was probably helpful that Jack masqueraded as a slum inhabitant and was not sort of interviewing these individuals, wearing the garb of, let's say, a middle-class, conventional slum traveller or philanthropist. So in this manner, he was probably able to get a better sense of what the living and working conditions of individuals employed in the sweated industries were really like. And from the many cases that he discusses, and there are very, very many cases that he discusses, I've chosen two from a chapter called Wages, which I want to discuss very briefly, and I think the second one is, in my view, particularly pertinent. So the first one here just gives us, as you can see, an indication of daily and weekly rates paid for work in the coat and trouser making business. He says, Jack says, "I've spoken with women in Whitechapel who receive right along less than 25 cents for a 12-hour day in the coat-making sweatshops, and with women trouser finishers who receive an average princely and weekly wage of 75 cents to $1. Obviously very interesting here. We can see clearly that Jack London is writing with an American audience in mind, because he provides the monetary equivalent in dollars and cents. So he's obviously trying to give his fellow American citizen an idea of what life in British slums is like. And it's interesting, in actually many places in the text, he directly compares the scenes he observes in Britain's slums in the East End of London with life at home in the United States. And it's probably needless to say that, in most cases, these comparisons are in favour of life in the United States, in most cases. Anyway, but What is very apparent here in many of the scenes and many of the situations he describes in this chapter entitled Rages is actually Jack's commitment to writing in what he calls in one of his letters a graphic reportorial style. I think the second of my examples of case studies can be considered a good illustration of Jack's preferred style. So he reports here the case of a young girl, 12 years of age, who has been charged in the police court with stealing food. And then he describes the scene a little bit. She was found the deputy mother of a boy of 9, a crippled boy of 7, and a young child. Her mother was a widow and a blouse maker. She paid $1.25 a week rent. Here are the last items in her housekeeping account. Tea, 1 cent. Sugar, 1 cent. Bread, 0.5 cent. Margarine, 2 cents. Oil, 3 cents. And firewood, 1 cent. Good housewives of the soft and tender folk, imagine yourself marketing and keeping house on such a scale, setting a table for 5 and keeping an eye on your deputy mother of 12 to see that she did not steal food for her little brothers and sisters while you stitched at a nightmare line of blouses which stretched away into the gloom and down to the pauper's coven, a yawn for you. So what starts as a seemingly dispassionate account of facts and figures, we know as a young girl, 12 years of age, in the police court, we find out that the mother is a widow and a blouse maker, can get a pretty detailed inventory of household expenses. So what starts as a sort of matter-of-fact description and gives way almost mid-sentence to something, I think, very, very different. So you can see there, there's a very apparent shift in tone in this short description at the point at which Jack directly addresses his readers, the good housewives of the soft and tender folk. So he implores them to put themselves into the position of the poor mother who is desperately trying to provide food and shelter for her children by hard work. That is obviously ruining her health, but is obviously also not enough to provide enough food or sustenance for her family, so that her daughter is driven to more desperate and illegal attempts to secure food for her siblings. And I think this is this very interesting conflation of very different writing styles in Jack's account is fascinating. It interests me very much, because I think in this very polymorphic sort of uneven style, we have a good example here of what he calls his graphic reportorial voice. So there are many facts, descriptions and observations in The People of the Abyss, but these sections are paired and juxtaposed with very emotive outbursts, with political estimates and predictions, or with appeals to the reader, like the one I just discussed. And indeed, throughout this book, especially in the second half, Jack consistently addresses the reader in the attempt to break down the barrier between middle-class reader and working-class object of study. So here is one particular important example appearing in a chapter called The Ghetto. So Jack says, the application of the golden rule determines that East London is an unfit place in which to live, where you, the reader, where you would not have your own babe live and develop and gather to itself knowledge of life and the things of life, is not a fit place for the babes of other men to live and develop and gather to themselves knowledge of life and the things of life. Note the repetition here to really emphasize that he's talking. He draws a direct comparison between the reader and the situations of these people whose lives he observes on a daily basis. And then he continues. It is a simple thing, this golden rule, and all that is required. Political economy and the survival of the fittest can go hang if they say otherwise. What is not good enough for you is not good enough for other men, and there is no more to be said. I mean, it's probably very difficult to argue with Jack on this last point. So very obvious, compelling, and persuasive is that associative reading of East End inhabitants and reader that he's developing in passages like this one here. We might also already notice here his socialist leanings in this passage, and I'll talk a little bit more about it, because the actual foe for Jack London is actually modern capitalism. He's warning capitalism responsible for an uneven distribution of wealth and for creating a social order that continues to rely on this division between owners and workers, consumers and producers, rich and poor, west and east. And the list is, I think, ongoing. So I said I will come back to this in a minute or so, but I want to return very briefly to the topic of this versatile voice or writing style. And I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture that, for me at least, his ability to write in this particular style is indicative of his fascination with appearance, performance, and disguise. So to put it in very simple terms, while Jack manages to speak in many different voices in The People of the Abyss, he also relishes in the possibility to assume different identities and personas in real life. And although he complains in letters to his friends, as we've seen, about the hardships endured during his weeks in the East End, the suggestion to impersonate a slum inhabitant for the purpose of a reportorial observation was certainly very seductive. So it fostered and really spoke to his sense of adventure, this interest in the unknown. So I want to turn now to Jack's own comments on this transformation. From relatively well-to-do American journalist to East Ender who tries to find work, who sleeps in workhouses and queues up for free breakfasts provided by the Salvation Army. So before he takes lodgings in the East End, Jack orders a cabman to drive him to a shop that sells second-hand clothes. These are all photographs. Most of them are photographs from The People of the Abyss. So at this second-hand clothes shop, he tries to buy new old clothes, if you want to say that way. And also it takes him quite a while to persuade the shop owner that he really is truly interested in purchasing old and above all worn and shabby clothes. He finally manages, as he says here, to purchase a new set of trousers, a jacket and shoes. In the end, he states, I selected a pair of stout, though well-worn trousers, a frayed jacket with one remaining button, a pair of brogans which had plainly seen service when coal was shoveled, a thin leather belt, and a very dirty cloth cap. Back in his room, the next day, he then begins the transformation act. Here, he says, in his room, the next day, I took off my shoes, not without regret for their lightness and comfort, and my soft grey travelling suit, and in fact, all my clothing, and proceeded to array myself in the clothes of the other and unimaginable men who must have been indeed unfortunate to have had to part with such rags for the pitiful sum obtainable from a dealer. Out in the streets, in his new second-hand outfit, then Jack immediately begins to notice the difference that clothes can make, both in a positive and in a negative sense. First, he proposes that his new attire actually establishes a sense of solidarity between him and other members of the working class. So he says, no sooner was I out on the street than I was impressed by the difference in status affected by my clothes. All civility vanished from the demeanor of the common people with whom I came in contact. Presto. In the twinkling of an eye, so to say, A had become one of them. My frayed and outed elbow jacket was the badge and advertisement of my class, which was their class. It made me like kind, and in place of the fawning and too respectful attention I had hitherto received, I now shared with them a comradeship. The man in corduroy and dirty neckerchief no longer addressed me as sir or governor. It was mate now, and a fine and hearty word with a tingle to it and a warmth and gladness which the other term does not possess. In my rags and tatters, Jack continues, I escaped the pestilence of tipping and encountered men on the basis of equality. It's obviously very positive in his views. But this very desirable democratizing result produced by these clothes is more than matched by a second, more perturbing insight. He continues, other changes I discovered, Jack says, were wrought with my condition, by my new garb. In crossing crowded thoroughfares, I found I had to be, if anything, more lively in avoiding vehicles, and it was strikingly impressed upon me that my life had cheapened in direct ratio with my clothes. The fact that his life is now worth less, I mean, he's wearing tattered rags, might seem very obvious to us as readers, but it certainly seems to come as some kind of surprise or revelation to Jack. So it's starting to indicate the signifying power of clothes and other objects of dress. They have the ability, on the one hand, to signal class solidarity, as in the first example here. They break down, you know, this distinction between him and working class men predominantly. But at the same time, they enable observers to rightly or wrongly associate their wearer with a particular class. So what Jack suggests in his comments here is that people adjust their behavior in direct response to encountering someone else's clothes. The garments are responsible for the construction of class identity, and they significantly influence the way in which onlookers engage with and respond to the wearer. And I think, again, as I said, Jack, I think, revels in this possibility of changing his persona with these second-hand clothes. And it might be worth mentioning here at this point that he took a number of precautions to make sure he could escape the clutches of the underworld at any given time. Not only did he rent a room in a more respectable part of the East End, to which you could just retreat to recover, to get a good night's sleep and get a good meal. But he would also saw a gold coin into his garments that could and also would be used in an emergency. Now, I'm not mentioning this here to accuse Jack London of hypocrisy. Just want to mention it here because I want to show that this point out that it actually seems to show his awareness of the possible outcome of his potentially very dangerous adventure. So he seemed to have known very well that this transformation that he underwent by just putting on these secondhand clothes could have very unforeseeable and undesirable consequences. So effective was obviously the signifying power of clothes and garments that Jack London felt that he had to protect himself against all eventualities. Now, however, the very same outfit that, as he said, cheapened his life in direct ratio with his clothes was instrumental in giving him access to people, places, and many stories that would have probably not have been accessible to him had he worn his normal clothes. Indeed, in the outfit of the working class men, he collected material that would be later published in the People of the Abyss, as I said, in which he rhetorically assumes, very often, the role of his chosen alter ego, the unemployed working class man who's looking for a place to stay for his very large family. And once more, I think the voice he adopts in these passages is interesting because it reflects the sometimes not so sort of latent cynicism that characterized many of his observations. So the following passage here evaluates possible residences for his imaginary family, and it's quite indicative of a sort of cynicism that we've encountered throughout the People of the Abyss. He says, "True, the sanitation of the places I visited was wretched. From the imperfect sewage and drainage, defective traps, poor ventilation, dampness and general foulness, I might expect my wife, the imaginary wife and the imaginary babies, speedily to be attacked by a number of unpronounceable diseases and various kinds of disorders. Certainly the death rate would be exceedingly high. But," he says again, "observe again the beauty of the adjustment. The most rational act for a poor man in East London with a large family is to get rid of it. The conditions in East London are such that they will get rid of the large family for him." And I think Jack's sarcasm, observable in the last sentence, manages to confront and challenge sort of opinions by political economists who proposed population control and eugenics as possible ways of dealing with the problems in the East End. And very directly, Jack voices in passages such as these and elsewhere his critique of a capitalist system that purposefully ignores and neglects those individuals it actually relies on to sustain itself. So, see, for instance, this extract here from The People of the Abyss, in which Jack, on first arriving in London, seems to have asked loads of his acquaintances about possible routes into the East End. So he goes around and says, like, how do I get to the East End? Where do I go? And apparently, you know, the response was, but we know nothing of the East End. It is over there, somewhere. He's obviously appalled by, in response to his request. And, he says, his acquaintances would wave their hands vaguely in the direction where the sun, on rare occasions, may be seen to rise. And now we come to the real cynicism of this passage in the next sentences. He continues, then I shall go to Cook's. Oh, yes, they said with relief. Cook will be sure to know. And that Jack's cynicism comes really to the fore here. But, O Cook, O Thomas Cook and son, pathfinders and trail clearers, living signposts to all the world and bestowers of first aid to bewildered travellers, unhesitatingly and instantly, with ease and celerity, could you send me to darkest Africa or innermost Tibet, but to the east end of London, barely a stone's throw distant from that circus, you know not the way. I think what comes across in Jack's really bitter remarks is his critique of an apparent middle and upper class ignorance here represented by the travel agent agency Thomas Cook. And, you know, sort of ignorance regarding the circumstances affecting people so close at hand. Maps, routes, and other advice on how to navigate exotic, faraway countries can be easily and speedily provided. But the very same individuals who are attracted by the adventurous locations abroad completely forget about aspects of the world that's right there on their doorstep. And Jack proposes this obliviousness is in many cases probably intentional rather than honest and authentic. So turning a blind eye on living conditions in the slums and constructing the East End as this dark place akin to Britain's overseas territories to facilitate an attitude of conscious neglect that ultimately helps exactly to sustain the particular the socioeconomic status quo that he's critiquing so ferociously in The People of the Abyss. And I've seen response to what he perceives to be this, you know, common attitude among many middle-class Londoners. Jack proposes that there are very apparent synergies between the so-called respectable class and the masses living in the slums. So obviously, without the poorly paid labour undertaking in the East End, he argues, there would be no luxury millinery items or ornaments consumed and purchased by the upper classes. So in his view, the two sides of the current socio-economic system are very codependent and much more interrelated than the so-called respectable society would like to believe. And it's in the last chapter of The People of the Abyss that he drives home this point with particular, particular force by drawing attention to the interconnectedness and the interdependencies between the managing class, as he calls it, and the paupers in the East End. So he says, the food this managing class eats, the wine it drinks, the shows it makes, and the fine clothes it wears are challenged by 8 million mouths which have never had enough to fill them, and by twice 8 million bodies which have never been sufficiently clothed. It is also at this place that he voices in no uncertain terms his opinion of the capitalist system and its imminent future. So he continues. It is inevitable that this management, which has grossly and criminally mismanaged, shall be swept away. Not only has it been wasteful and inefficient, but it has misappropriated the funds. Every worn-out, pasty-faced pauper, every blind man, every prison babe, every man, woman, and child whose belly is gnawing with hunger pangs is hungry because the funds have been misappropriated by the management. So capitalism, Jack proposes here, might have produced luxury and advanced the progress of some individuals, but civilization has not necessarily produced a wholesale improvement of people's quality of life. In fact, he closes his study with another comparison. The very last paragraph of The People of the Abyss juxtaposes the life led by the so-called men of civilization, as he you know, refers to them throughout, with that of the Inuits, a group of indigenous people inhabiting the Arctic regions of Canada and the United States. He says here, there can be no mistake. Civilization has increased man's producing power 100-fold. However, through mismanagement, the men of civilization live worse than the beasts and have less to eat and wear and protect them from the elements than the savage Inuit in a frigid climate who lives today as he lived in the Stone Age 10,000 years ago. So much then, according to Jack London, for the progress and the uninhibited advance of civilization. Now, after his very short vacation in the East End, Jack went back to the United States, wrote more commercially successful stories, and finally moved to Sonoma County in California, where he purchased a ranch and hoped to live the life of an ecologically conscious farmer. This enterprise was pretty much an economic failure, quite a disaster, effectively, and it forced him to write successive pot boilers just to get enough money to keep things afloat. And he died very young, at the age of 40, and there's ongoing speculation about the exact cause of his death, but it's generally acknowledged that his alcoholism probably was somewhat instrumental in bringing it about. Today, he's mostly remembered as the writer of gripping adventure stories. Many, if not most, American teenagers will be familiar with his short story, To Build a Fire. Very good reading, highly recommended. And lesser known, at least in the United States, is the text that I talked about today, The People of the Abyss. And like his novels and shorter fiction, it is actually characterized with very graphic, very memorable descriptions of people, events, and situations. And I think although Jack London can be faulted for many things, for very many things, so for instance, he all but ignored philanthropic attempts undertaken by many turn-of-the-century Londoners to help people, to alleviate the plight of the poor. So he can be accused of all sorts of things. But I think, nonetheless, his work represents one of the most compelling and I think also most of the most upsetting accounts of life in London's East End at the turn of the 20th century. Thank you very much.